This week, we're talking about Ferrari's Testarossa revival, plus Polestar's first all-in-house designed car, and a guy that got a DUI driving a Power Wheels. We also have a very special guest host this week, professional racing driver and founder of Fast Sideways Racing School, Nick Romano, joins us in the studio. Welcome to the Big Three. Welcome back to the Big Three, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me this week, we got Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, welcome to be here.
Great. Really good. And Nick Romano.
How's it going?
You may have seen Nick on The Drive recently, debunking snap oversteer. Nick, how long? I've known you for since like 2020 or something now, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
Because you were doing endurance racing, I think is when I met you, right?
Did we meet
at a work series race, I think.
What team were you with?
Technic, Team Technic. Oh,
that's right. You were with Technic, yep. And I was with Palomar, who I'm still with.
Okay. That's right. Okay.
We met in passing there. Yes. But then we met a bunch of times at Speed Ventures.
That's right. Speed Ventures doing autocross there. You have a series on your channel where you were trying to get a S197 Mustang to do a sub-2 minute at Button Willow. And when I had my Mustang, I was following along very closely with that. Unfortunately, I never got to take my Mustang out there. But yeah, man, happy to have you here.
Even after you got all the upgrades.
Yeah, you know, I never really took it to like a track day because it had the automatic, which was really terrible. It was fine for autocross. I would just stick it in the second gear and do pretty decently. But like at a track, you know, on straights, and it was like, okay, I'm at full throttle on the straight here. Yeah, I might as well shift into the fifth gear. At like 3,500 RPM, why not?
It's not much better with a 5-speed.
Yeah, that's too bad. I saw like one of the Coyote powered ones for sale recently. I was like, maybe I'll dip my toes back into the Mustang S197. I just like that platform a lot.
Yeah, but I do too. It's sort of I kind of likened it to the American version of the AE86 because it's a sort of uninspired, wheezy engine that just so happens to have some fun characteristics. Mm-hmm. It's a strut front end and a solid axle rear end. It's basically just like a cheap parts bin car that for whatever reason, you put all those parts together and it becomes more than the sum of its parts. For some reason, even though it's got a terrible weight balance and uninspired suspension, it just happens to be good.
I loved taking it out to the autocross. And like, if I saw someone with a WRX, I knew I wasn't going to beat any of the Miatas. Like there's just no way. But someone with like a WRX or a Z, I would be looking at their times and being like, okay, I want to try to like make them
that's your bench.
Yeah. And you know, I think it punched pretty high above its weight with a few mods, like good tires and suspension here and there. But Nick is gonna lend his expertise to some of these stories this week. And when you said Palomar Racing, that just like I was like we'd always be like not fighting you guys, but in close competition with you guys. And
awesome battles with Technic. Auto Club Speedway in particular is the one that is strongest in my memory because I think it was, who was driving? I can't remember who was in the car, in your car. Mm. But we had this back and forth battle. Oh, no, wait a minute. I wasn't with Palomar at the time. That was when I was racing with Peter.
Okay.
Peter Onepo. Mm-hmm. Remember Peter? Mm-hmm. And we were in almost identical cars. Like they were basically Speccy 46s were just sort of modified a little bit. This back and forth battle, we had a little bit of corner speed. You guys had a little bit of straight line speed. And it was just incredible because we basically did, you know, it's an endurance race. So in theory, you are not really driving 10/10. You're just sort of kind of being a little bit chill, being a little bit conservative. But no, we were basically qualifying and or sprint racing for the full 3 hours. There was never a chance to take a break because if you did, like, the other car would just get away. It was a fun times.
I had never been like huge into endurance racing before getting to be with Technic for like a couple years there. And afterwards, like I have such a respect for it because like you're right. You're trying to save the car as much as you can for as long as you can. But then, you know, there becomes times during a race when you do have to go all out and like risk breaking something or, you know, wear on the car, and it's just like it's so unique in that, and it's just
the strategery
is very important. Yes. And also when the sun goes down, and I was doing a lot of spotting, so like I would tell our car when, you know, either competitors were behind or ahead, or like, hey, like, oh, here's a Porsche GT3 car that's out here with us for some reason. Make sure you let them by. But when the sun goes down and all you can do is identify the cars by just a few lights that are on each of them, you get to know mm-hmm. each car in the grid by their set of lights. And it's just like, so cool, you know? Yeah.
And that moment, it's a pretty long moment between when the sun is up and when the sun is fully down. When you're driving, you're blind pretty much. It's mm-hmm. worse. It's worse than when the sun is all the way down, because then you can rely on your headlights, or if your headlights are terrible, you rely on the headlights of the car in front of you,
yeah.
which is a big deal, by the way. There's only so much you can do with your own headlights, especially if they're not, you know, super high dollar, mm-hmm. you know, real pro team endurance racing lights. But if you can get in behind a car, hopefully that maybe is just a little bit faster than you, mm-hmm. but is maybe struggling in at night, that way you can just take advantage of them lighting the way for you.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Oh my God, it's so helpful. That cool. saved us at our first endurance race with Palomar at Willow Springs. Mm-hmm. We put a lot of effort into the headlights, and there were these like big, you know, fancy off-road, high wattage LED. And we had an array of all these different types. Mm-hmm. So we'd have projectors, we'd have wide angle. We even had apex lights. The main headlights were on one circuit. The corner lights were on a different circuit. The main circuit got a short and blew. So we lost all of our lights except for the apex lights. And I was fortunate. I didn't have to deal with that. Matt Million, our other driver,
had to do
his entire stint with nothing but apex lights. And if you look at the video, it looked like maybe it was a little better in person mm-hmm. than it was in the video, but holy crap. Yeah. I don't know how he did it. He couldn't see anything.
That kid can drive. I say kid, he's now well into his 20s. Yeah, but when I met him, he was like, I think 18 or 19. Yeah. He can drive, man. Yeah. Okay. As I mentioned, Nick, you were on the drive recently discussing snap oversteer, whether or not it
which you boldly claim doesn't exist.
Yes.
And everybody agrees that it doesn't, and we were correct. Everyone agrees, just across the board.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Check the comment.
I will not verify that. Yes. So, sorry, could you tell the audience, if they haven't seen it yet, what the premise was and how you went about exploring and disproving the notion of snap oversteer?
Sure. So, snap oversteer, despite what the funny thing is, if you read through some of the comments, and I did read through some of the comments,
bad move, dude. I know,
terrible move. Hey, look, I'm new at this. Give me a chance to ease my way into knowing what to do. But yeah, so there's a lot of different opinions on what snap oversteer even means. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because a lot of them were very confident in their definition. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what snap oversteer is. That snap oversteer is what happens when the car is sliding one direction and then you correct it and then it goes the other way.
Mm-hmm. Which you also cover as like, here's, I think regardless of whether you come out of the video convinced that this isn't a thing or not, you cover all of the bases, I think, and say, well, let's say if you think it's this, and then you explain it. And I'll summarize it, but I think what you're saying is, does it exist? Does it not? I'm not going to answer that. But what you are saying is, if something happens, it's not the car. Mm-hmm. Some cars are harder to handle, but if something happens, it's not the car, it's the driver.
It's the inputs.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you. We've sort of like skipped to the end, mm-hmm. and maybe then we'll come back and get there. But so everything that a car does, 99% of the things that a car does, barring like a fault, a failure, hitting a patch of oil or something like that, mm-hmm. Is a result of the inputs of the driver. So if a car gets oversteer, whether or not the driver knew that it was going to happen determines what we're going to define it as. Determines the outcome and how we're going to define it. Right? So my take on this is that a snap oversteer is a result of a driver not knowing what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if it's a case where it is just oversteer, but the driver wants to call it snap oversteer because they don't know, or they haven't practiced yet the skills mm-hmm. to be able to know what was going to happen and mm-hmm. how to deal with it, then it's very common for them to say, oh, this car snapped on me. Mm-hmm. But did it though? Because a lot of these descriptions that I saw of what snap oversteer really is, it's just oversteer. Mm-hmm. It's just, you're in a corner, you lift off, and the car and the back end comes around all of a sudden, and there was nothing I could do.
Yeah.
It's like, wasn't there though.
Yeah.
That's just plain and simple. That's oversteer. You lift off, you transfer weight forward, and the car does exactly what you told it to do.
But what about when the turbo kicks in?
if only they had used an MR2 in this video. Yeah. I love that one. It's like, we did, guys. Yeah. Watch the video. And the point we made about the turbo is,
yeah,
if you've hit the throttle a couple of times in your car, the timing is going to be pretty much the same. You've got to, if as long as you've done it a couple of times, you know when the boost is going to come on. You can hear the turbo mm-hmm. too. And you can use that information to your advantage to say, okay, well, I know if I just put my big dumb foot down on the floor, it is going to spin up the rear tires and that will create some oversteer. So maybe don't do that. Maybe mm-hmm. sneak up on it. Maybe listen for the turbo. And when it starts to spool, take some of that throttle away so you can have a consistent amount of thrust. Yeah. Because there's a consistent amount of torque being put to the rear wheels. So for 99.9% of these situations, you can always do something differently behind the wheel with the controls of the car to create a better outcome. Mm-hmm. That's really the point.
Yeah. Whose MR2 is that, by the way?
Bob Pham. Okay. You recognize the car?
I did. I was like, oh, I've seen it.
It's pretty sweet.
Yes. Anybody who knows anything about MR2s, especially in Southern California, knows that car.
Yeah.
It's pretty legendary. Yeah.
It's a cool video, I think.
Really well done. Yeah. Great video.
Thank you.
Yeah.
To say it's worth checking out is an understatement. Mm-hmm. It is definitely worth watching. It's a great exploration. And you'll either really appreciate it or you get really mad. still worth watching.
Yeah. So, very good.
Thank you.
Really well done.
Yeah. It is funny that like the term snap oversteer
is a boogeyman. And that's, I liked the fact that you guys say that explicitly too, where it's.
And that also, you know, it's viewed negatively when I feel like after going to a few track days now, doing a lot of autocross, getting to drive a bunch of different cars and learn how they drive is like, that's one of my, liftoff oversteer is one of my favorite tricks to employ to like get the car to do what you want.
Yeah. If you can't achieve rotation. Mm-hmm. With liftoff or a little bit of trail brake, then that's just a car that understeers a lot.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about it too is that, you know, there's different versions of the S2000, different versions of the SW20, and over time they went more towards an understeer bias to try to protect a driver who's not that experienced with performance driving. Right? If you make the car just understeer all the time, then hopefully you'll never get yourself into a sketchy situation where the back end comes around.
Yeah.
But the irony of that is, if the car has a lot of understeer, but somehow you still manage to achieve oversteer, it's usually way worse than if it just had a nice, smooth, for most people, right? Mm-hmm. For most people, understeer is safer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for a lot of the listeners or watchers of this podcast or Donut or The Drive, these are automotive enthusiasts. They're people who enjoy driving and generally want to learn how to do more to control their car better. And so that's really the message that I hope most people get is, hey, there's stuff you can learn about this to improve your driving repertoire, and then maybe oversteer won't be so scary.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
If you haven't seen the video, go check it out. But Nick, do you have any beginner tips that we can convey over the audio medium to the listener about how to be a better driver? Do you have any hot tips?
Sure. And actually this kind of goes off of a comment or a concern that I saw people have about driving and about oversteer quite a few times in response to the video. And that is bumps in the road or crests, anything other than a smooth, perfect pavement. And that's totally valid because bumps do have an effect on behavior of the car. And especially if the suspension geometry of a car has toe change intentionally, it's going to have a stronger effect. The big catch-all that can impact the way everybody drives, whether it's on track, on the street.
Never
ever lift, no matter what. It doesn't matter what's about to happen. No, don't do that. If you always expect the tires to slip, you will never be surprised when they do.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So if you follow that idea, your hands and your feet can be prepared for whatever comes next. And the better you can get at predicting the future, predicting what the car is about to do, the less you're relying on reaction timing. Mm-hmm. Because if, especially if a car like an S2000, which is going to respond very quickly, if you're reliant on reaction timing and the car is already sideways, there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. You're going to spin it out. It doesn't matter how fast your hands are. But if you know what is likely about to happen, you could be prepared for it. You can take the slack out of your arms and be ready to make a quick motion, etc. And that's true of bumps as well. So like this is really big on track, especially button willow with all the curbs. Well, if you want to be faster on button willow, you're using the curbs, right? You're chucking half the car up in the air. But if you kept the steering in while doing that, while you're losing half of your grip, the car is going to respond, right? You're going to lose that grip and very likely you're going to go into oversteer. So if you want to truly attack curbs or bumps with the maximum amount of tire grip available to you, as you are hitting that curb and the car is losing grip, you can take some of that steering angle away and in sort of in preparation for the grip loss that is about to happen. And the same is true on the road if you hit a bump. If you feel the suspension compressing rapidly, do something about it. Mm-hmm. Take that steering away because you know, or you can know what's about to happen next is you're going to lose some of that grip. So if you watch the hands of any like really fast pro driver, they're never static for very long, right? They're always
micro adjustments.
Yeah. For these little adjustments, these little changes in the slip angle of the tires, which is something we're going to get into on a later video, probably, hopefully.
Cool.
Really exploring slip angle, but the slip angle is happening all the time. And if you know that the slip angle is about to change, you can do something about it before it bites you in the ass. There you go.
Okay.
One big giant bullet point.
Yeah. I guess like when we're talking about, there's like different levels of driving skill, like relying purely on reaction time, like you're talking about, that's like one level. But when you elevate that and get enough practice where you're already predicting and you're already, I guess, in tune of what the car is going to do at that particular track, that's when you really reach like that, Nirvana stage, I guess, like your Max Verstappen's out there, as opposed to, I don't know, some less skilled.
As opposed to your Nolan Sykes, who are
definitely not even trying to be good at reaction time, just trying to keep it on
stay
the,
alive.
The straight line. Yeah, yeah.
That same idea, though, can help you in a straight line. If you're trying to do a burnout and you are not expecting the rear end to start to move around, then that's when you end up finding crowds, leaving a meet. It's
news time.
Let's
Should we talk some news, guys? All right. Ferrari is reviving a legendary nameplate. They revealed the all-new 849 Testarossa last week. It will replace the SF90 Stradale. It's got a 4-liter twin-turbo V8 plug-in hybrid system, making a combined 1,036 horsepower. The V8 alone makes just 819 of those ponies.
I love that idea, too, of like, what happens if I don't charge it? Who cares?
Yeah. You
know? Yeah.
Are you ever going to truly notice that difference?
Exactly.
Only 800 and what, 819?
Yeah. 819.
Bummer. What are you going to do with that?
A paltry 819. Mm-hmm. The Testarossa is going to start at a scant $540,000 in Italy. The U.S. price is still unknown because of tariffs. The Drive reported it already has, quote, an army of haters. People are dragging the car in the comment sections of articles about this car. Ferrari, one of the main issues being that Ferrari no longer works with Pininfarina, which I did not realize until very recently after the car was revealed. It doesn't have the side strakes either.
We got to do like first impressions, but we didn't have we didn't have all the deets, all the, and of course, other people's reactions to it now. What do you think, Nolan?
Well, the strakes got to come back. It can't be a Testarossa without those.
Yeah.
Nick, have you driven any like modern Ferraris?
Yeah, none of the super crazy high-end ones.
Mm-hmm.
But all of your 430s through 488s, I haven't driven. What replaced 488? I haven't driven that yet, but it's got some different nomenclature.
There's a 488 Pista, I think, was one of them. The SF90, I think, is like kind of like the next.
Yeah, that's a higher tier. One. So it's a higher tier that I haven't driven yet.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Look at that thing.
Look, I don't think it's a bad looking car.
No.
I think you're running into the problem of what is your heritage?
Mm-hmm.
How do you look forward and back at the same time? And I think that's why people are pissed about it.
When Deal and I were driving the... what was the model called?
Was it a 400i or a Mondial or something?
Mondial,
like that?
Thank you. Yeah. So Deal and I were driving the Mondial for that video. We were going through Beverly Hills. We saw an SF90 in yellow parked on the side of the road.
That's a taxi cab in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, it was sick. In person, I'm sure this thing will look amazing. But for that video, we also stopped at a garage that specializes in Ferraris of that era, including the original Testarossa. And like, we just got to stand there and be with one and be like, oh my God, this thing is just incredible.
Yeah.
So to bring that nameplate back, I think if you're not going to give people like that Testarossa look, I think you're only begging them to be pissed about this new design.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton.
Yeah, exactly. How do you not have those side scoops, you know?
I agree with that too, but the visual language is much, much different, which it should be some differences, but it should be recognizable. This doesn't look like...
You got to remember, though, that the Testarossa that we're all thinking of is not the original Testarossa.
Okay.
There were Testarossas in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So when that car came out in the 80s, like that was a massive departure.
Took the place.
Right. That's that was true. A massive departure from the original look, which was, you know, swoopy, late 50s, early 60s, very organic. To go from that organic shape to like the widest, most square, flattest with the straight lines and the strakes and everything. That's a big departure.
Damn, I hate to... No, you're right.
It's true.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Okay, so...
So is part of the story...
It's changing my opinion now. It's
constantly...
A little bit.
You have to reinvent it completely? I don't know, but do you have to make it look like it's in a Tron movie?
It is a little bit like cyberpunk, isn't
it? It's very cyberpunk-y.
And the interesting thing is, like, some of the details there... They look like classic Ferrari, but not necessarily Testarossa. Like that black line across the front. To me, that's giving Daytona. Remember the Daytona with the pop-ups? And there were certain, I don't know which ones had it, but there were certain ones that had that black stripe across the center.
Yeah, that is a Ferrari hallmark. And Ferrari's defense too, like I think it's the SP3 is the SP3 Daytona that they also offer. I think that has like a lot of like the 80s linear, Testarossa. Yeah. Design elements on it.
Yeah.
You think maybe Ferrari called it a Testarossa specifically to light the internet on fire?
There's a possibility. Honestly, that's a possibility. Yeah. Because they could have called it anything they wanted.
And if they did, it's working.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Otherwise, like, I probably wouldn't even care about this car that looks very similar to the previous model that I also didn't really care too much about. I'm not the target audience for a $500,000 Ferrari.
If you look at the nose, I know last time I said it looks like a Dodge, like the electric Charger. But if you go back to that last picture, if you get rid of that front splitter, that's a Ferrari line.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just there's other elements that are piled on it. And I'm not even saying it doesn't look like a Ferrari. I'm just saying that name Testarossa is, you know.
Then we start running up into... performance considerations because obviously these cars have to get faster and more impressive every time.
1,086 horsepower,
right?
You know, so you need things to keep it on the ground that you didn't need in the 80s.
And for a long time, Ferrari's done a really, really good job of being able to hide the aerodynamic elements, relying a lot on underbody aero. But when you look at some of the cars that it's competing with, like they've sort of left that idea in the past and they've gone for the more GT style, race car style aerodynamics and if you want those numbers, you have to do something. And so a lot of the elements that we're seeing here are maybe necessary to hit the numbers they want to hit.
Yeah. Your experience is showing, Nick Romano. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're totally right about that. I also just think like Ferrari, like with them not working with Pininfarina, you know, they have to like figure this out on their own, their brand identity out on their own. There might be like some concession. Like,
but there's... To Ferrari's credit, I'm sure there was discussion of like, are we Ferrari or are we Pininfarina? Like, what is we need our own design. And I think that while people might be pissed about it, like, good. Like, let's see what Ferrari is.
Well, this designer is not new to Ferrari anyway.
Right, that's true.
There's
too.
A whole list of cars that this designer and this design firm have done. Some I believe the 458, which is like generally considered to be one of the prettiest of the modern Ferrari designs, that was the same designer.
Okay.
Should we talk a little more about the strakes before we move?
I mean,
the strakes are like the single biggest design cue from the 80s Testarossa that people love. Did you know that those were not supposed to be on the car?
No,
I did not.
Those were a response to a law, and I couldn't tell you where the law was, where like you couldn't have uncovered radiators or something like that on the sides
and
of the car.
So that counted as uncovered
thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Dang nabbit.
Yeah. Wow. And so those got thrown on and it just became iconic.
Yeah.
Just sort of by accident, right?
That's cool.
This has, you know,
an it's
equally
got the holes.
Equally polarizing, maybe. The vertical, which I don't know, doesn't necessarily flow with the rest of the lines quite as well. But
I feel like with so many cars that we talk about on the show anyway, like you'll see the pictures and you're like, I just don't get it. And then you see them in person, you're like, okay.
Or then you'll see them move.
Yeah.
In person too, which is a whole nother level of, oh shit.
Yeah. Oh, they're cooking.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll reserve my final judgment of this $500,000 car until I see one in person for myself. Yeah. How about that?
Until it's in my garage.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Speaking of a drive,
talking about a car you can afford.
Yeah. Speak for yourself.
Actually, Power Wheels are going up.
I'm sure they are, dude. So. I'm sure they are. The drive reported last week on a Canadian man that was pulled over for driving on the road in a Barbie Jeep and ended up getting himself a DUI. The man in question is from British Columbia, and the Barbie Jeep in question isn't an actual Jeep at all. It's a Power Wheels Jeep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the man was reportedly wearing pit vipers and a shirt that read, let's do it in the dumbest way possible.
Which he did.
Which he did.
I'm wondering, do you get pulled over because you're in the Power Wheels or because you're driving erratically in a Power Wheels? Reckless driving in a Power Wheels has got to be pretty bad.
Pretty bad, dude.
Well, we've all seen videos of that kid whose dad up to the voltage on his Power Wheels, and he's, I think it was a Mustang, and he's drifting it around.
Yeah.
So it is possible to hoon in a Power Wheels if you're determined enough.
Yeah. The man already had a suspended license, which he says is why he chose to take the toy Jeep in the first place. In a CBC interview, he said, quote, I just wanted to get a Slurpee. I got lazy and I didn't want to walk. Yeah.
I think they misspelled Florida in this article.
I could see that. Oh, we got some video. There it is.
Oh my God, that is a tiny. That's not even a. That's like a compact Power Wheels.
Yeah,
that's a
small one.
Good Lord.
So when I was growing up, I had a neighbor who did this, not in a Barbie Power Wheels Jeep, but in a
riding lawnmower?
No, that would be really good though. It was his mother-in-law's power wheelchair.
Nice.
Oh.
And he did get a DUI doing it.
Dang, dude. Gotta stay out of the road, I guess. Stay on the sidewalk.
If you stay on the sidewalk, you're probably good. Don't. Take that as
this
advice.
This is not legal advice.
I said probably.
Yeah, probably. Consult your lawyer first, I guess. Yeah. Polestar just released a new car called the 5. That's what they called it. Polestar 5. All right, let's take a look at this thing.
I think it's pretty cool looking. I think it's the front end looks nice. Yeah.
Okay.
This split headlight.
Yes.
A hallmark rally.
I've been seeing more and more of the Polestar like EV SUV around town, and they are pretty handsome, I'll say.
Their Polestar's got great design.
Nice. They're nice inside too. I had a an Uber driver pick me up in one before. It was really nice. I enjoyed it.
There you go. I still love how they keep kind of like the vintage, not vintage, but like that's definitely a Volvo
butt.
Taillight shape. Yeah. I do love that. Is this the one that it doesn't have like a rear window? It looks
right.
Like
that's the second one rear window. Doesn't have a rear window.
Second one. Wow. Very handsome car, very futuristic. So this thing makes 884 horsepower.
Why didn't they put a hybrid? Could have gotten up to 1,000.
Yeah. It rides on the first platform designed entirely in-house by Polestar. They want this car to compete with cars like the Porsche Taycan. And it is also incredibly heavy, being an EV at 5,600 pounds. Seems to be the Achilles heel of all these awesome EVs that are coming out, is that they're just heavier than hell. I do know that the Charger Daytona EV also weighs over like 5,000 pounds. Super. I mean, you can feel it when you drive it, too.
So is this Polestar, it's a five-seater. Is it a sedan or is it?
Yeah, it's a four-door sports sedan. You seen how the rear seats work?
Do you sit in them?
It's like a... it's amazing. You like bend your
knees.
Is
it two seats and then it moves? Like,
sort of.
Okay.
So you've heard of like a 2+2, right?
Yeah.
So this is almost like a 4+1, where it's got two normal seats in the back, and then the center console turns into a third seat, but it's like forward of the other two seats. Oh, kind of almost like... McLaren F1.
It's like when you used to stand on the bump for the drive shaft in the back of your parents' car. You could be like, hey, what's going up here in the front seat, guys?
I literally did that when I was like 3 years old. I think like they forgot to buckle me and I was like, what's going on? My parents were like, oh! That's very interesting. Oh, yeah, you could see that.
But you can see that there's definitely not space. A third seat normally.
That's funny.
That's so interesting.
They're bigger, right? And they're you feel like you sit a little higher, your roof line's a little higher. Do you think they're going kind of further to stay a sedan but encroach in the crossover size market? You know what I mean? As people are looking
like
a toward sedan that.
That's crossover sized and like feels like a crossover when you drive it. One of the big complaints that a lot of people I think have is like sitting too low in a car and not wanting to feel like they're, you know,
if because all the other cars are growing.
Yeah. So a sedan that has like the ergonomics of an SUV, I guess is a crossover, but like this really does look like a sedan.
How backwards is that though? Because for how many decades have we been trying to make trucks and SUVs feel more like cars?
Yeah.
And now we're trying to make cars feel more like SUVs.
I drove a 2024 F-150 for a video last year, and I was amazed by how well it drove in terms of like, it felt like I was driving just a big car.
Did you get the one with the coyote in it?
Yeah. It was sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sorry, Nick, you had a point.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, this is the first chassis that Polestar is making entirely in-house, and they say that it's an aluminum chassis. Who knows how much aluminum is actually in it, but I mean, with all of those extra measures that they took to reduce weight, it's still 5,600 pounds.
Still super heavy.
So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's got to come from somewhere. And we've seen, you know, time and time again.
It's not like they haven't been making big power numbers, you know, like that's not that new. So as far as like, oh, battery, motors, like, I feel like we've been here.
Maybe range? Does this have like a super high range or something?
An additional.
Maybe.
Because that is the new, I don't want to say it's a new buzzword, but it is the new race. Mm-hmm. I'd say
range and EVs. Definitely. Yeah. That is my problem with like, I've had the privilege of driving like, you know, Lucid Air, which I like very much, the Charger EV, which I liked, but I probably would not own in its current iteration. I've driven the Taycan, the, let's see, maybe that's it. Rivian, like they're nice to drive around town because they're very luxurious cars. But then when you do take them out and like try to push them a little bit, that's when you really feel how freaking heavy they are, and you just can't get past that, you know. And that's I would love to see an EV like this that weighs like 3,600 pounds, you know. That'd be cool.
Gonna have to wait for the battery tech to catch up to the desires. I think so, which it will eventually. I have faith in Polestar though.
If anybody's gonna do it, they've been ahead of the curve, I think, since inception.
Yeah, I mean, they were a race team before anything else. They know how to make a car go around a racetrack.
Yeah. Speaking of racetracks, Willow Springs has undergone its biggest change since it sold earlier this year. Some new paint and a little sprucing up at the track has it looking new and fresh. I mean, it seems like it's gone more than just paint and some sprucing up. It's had a lot of some overhauling over there.
The car track is just looking at shots. It's just gorgeous.
I haven't seen shots of the car track, but I did see their refresh of Streets of Willow, which I'm extremely excited about.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, it looks great.
Lots of green and white paint.
Yes.
New logo for the track as well. So, you know, all the most famous tracks have, I guess I don't have a logo on this shirt, but all the European tracks anyway, they all have their own very, very cool looking logos, and Willow Springs has one too now. So they didn't repave the actual track itself, Streets.
Okay, that makes sense, because it just got repaved.
Just got repaved like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But when they did that repave, they didn't do the skid pad corner.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That pavement was crumbling.
Yes.
Yes.
Like unusable. There was a giant pothole.
Yep.
I'll tell you after the show, my stories about that particular pothole.
You can tell us now.
my lawyers have told me that I can't tell that story. but yeah, so that finally got the repave that it needed. Mm-hmm. And then the extra new pavement on Streets is like different options for different layouts, which is pretty cool. So you could, if you're renting the track for a track day or whatever, you can have a bunch of different options for which layout you want to use. And even the skid pad corner, which used to
I noticed that too. You can tell the way they've paved it. There's different turnouts and there's different, it's pretty sick.
Yeah. And then the skid pad corner, which used to just be a sea of pavement, just sort of figured out. Now they have painted in the race corner, but they've done two of them. There's the normal one that we've been doing for years, and then there's one that's further away if you would like a longer version of the corner.
That's cool. Yeah. And that'll then leave you into a longer straight too. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. That's cool. I mean, speak that the skid pad corner there, I feel like, you know, I had a pretty decent handle on the rest of the course, but I feel like that always killed me because I would either go way too far out or like
so cut few short markers
and just like not have the momentum coming out. So that's really cool that they painted that. Do you have any insights on this, on the refreshes here that you just did a little eyebrow thing?
I think this is definitely good as someone who has been to that track, and we've talked about a lot of our apprehension, our concern mm-hmm. about a big takeover like this, an investment firm. I think this is a very, very good sign.
I don't
think it answers all of the questions about what's going to happen and anxieties, perhaps.
No.
But I do think this is a really cool thing to see. And I think what they've done so far, they've been doing right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's cool that they added some layout options so people won't have to go 100 miles an hour over that blind hill or the blind like crest into the downhill left-hand mm-hmm. kink that so many people have spun out on. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a rite of passage to spin out on that thing, yeah. but it's also incredibly scary when it happens.
Yep.
But now they have like an S section where it's take that a little easier before you get into there.
There's some video of the track there. It almost looks like Paul Ricard.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, it's very like Herman Tilke kind of inspired, at least with the paint design, it looks like. Mm-hmm. Like pretty cool. Oh, and there's that new logo. That is
it's pretty cool, right?
That's cool, man. It looks so nice.
The W that looks like flags.
Yes.
Right? It's like, oh, why didn't we think of that? You know?
And it looks like it's hard to tell from this video, but there's the there's the right hander. Like really banked section of the track. That was pretty treacherous. We actually did lose a car there one time on a shoot.
The bowl.
But it looks like they've put more bermage.
Yeah, they've added more runoff in a lot of places. But so the concern though, and it's a lot of the motorcycle track riders are pretty worried about this. They've added guardrails mm-hmm. to the outsides of a lot of these areas.
Oh.
So they added runoff. So you've got more mm-hmm. chance to not go off.
Yes.
But then if you do make a mistake big enough or have an issue and end up that far out, there is a guardrail there. And if you're in a car, like you're probably fine. If you're on a bike, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because you're hitting a solid object instead of just going out into the dirt. And then I think it may have already happened that somebody, I don't think they got hurt, but they did hit the guardrail and ended up back on the surface.
Oh.
So yeah, the motorcycle riders are not too thrilled about that.
Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty popular motorcycle course.
It is. And I've heard them saying that they're only going to run it in one direction for motorcycles now.
Okay.
Because of the layout of where the solid objects are.
I think that's a fair compromise instead of saying like, okay, then no bikes at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That'd be terrible if they just said no bikes at all. But I mean, it's not the only track that has guardrails. Obviously, like a lot of mm-hmm. Eastern, not necessarily East Coast, but Eastern tracks. Watkins Glen famously mm-hmm. has guardrails that are right there. We're kind of unique in California or some of the more like Midwestern states that we just have all this space. The tracks mm-hmm. were built in the desert with a lot of space. So there's room to just have endless runoff and grass or dirt mm-hmm. or whatever. That's not necessarily the case for a lot of these other tracks.
That makes sense.
So it's kind of turning more into that. But we'll see. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that a new track has been made locally and then there was feedback from the people who use the track, and then they made an adjustment mm-hmm. on with the circuit at Buttonwillow. Mm-hmm. There was an issue. People didn't like the safety factor. I forget which corner it was. And then right after, they said, you know what? You're right. And then went and made a change to it to make it safer. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be some feedback that the new owners agree with, and maybe they'll make some changes.
Buttonwillow has a new course altogether out there, right?
Like yeah, the circuit.
The circuit. Okay. I haven't been out there yet to see it, but have you had a chance to drive that? Yeah.
Yeah, I've been out there. It's a fun track. It's got some cool elevation changes. And then there's this this area. I don't know if it has an official name. I've been calling it the chute. Because mm-hmm. you basically have these sort of barriers on both sides and you come up over this crest into this chute and just visually it's very cool and that's interesting cool. and unique. Yeah. Cool. And there's some pretty challenging braking zones with not a lot of information, mm-hmm. and not a lot of good visual markers.
Yeah.
So you have to really study what it is that you're driving into to be able to know where to brake, where to turn mm-hmm. to get the most out of it.
Very cool. Racetracks are cool.
Yeah.
I like it. Are all these refurbishments, are they a sign that they're going to try to bring some certain racing series back to the track? I think so. I think at Big Willow, I have no insider information at all, but based off what I've seen from these two tracks, like the Paul Ricardification of streets and, I mean, just kind of the investment that's already been made in the track so far, I would love to see like some big national series come to Big Willow.
You were looking into what is the top level.
Oh yeah, like
right, because they don't have a hospital.
Because there's different levels.
Helipad's
right?
easy.
Yeah. So to get like, you know, F1 would not come there because there's no on-site hospital, like you said. But helipad, That brings it down to like a FIA level 2, or maybe I can't remember. It's the other way around. If 3 is highest or 1 is highest, I don't know. But yeah, you got to have a hospital. Having a hospital on site is like the top. That's where like F1 would go, IndyCar would go. And then like, but lower down, I feel like IMSA is like a sort of, it's not an unrealistic guess to see like, or that they would come to Big Willow. And like, you know, knowing some of the people that are like involved in the, in this investment, it's like, yeah, they're going to refurb it to get some pretty serious racing series out there. They wouldn't be doing that if they didn't think they could do that, I think. So I'm excited.
Yeah, that'd be super cool. I mean, there's only rumors. I don't know anything more about that. But I mean, I can't imagine why they wouldn't want to attract these big money bringing series. I mean, and that's why the track really kind of fell off in the first place, because the safety requirements kept getting higher and higher, and the track couldn't match them or didn't have the budget to be able to update it to match it.
I've never driven Big Willow, but I've heard it's, I mean, at when you're on the backstretch of it, like on the main straights and stuff, it's pretty hairy, right?
It's fast.
Yeah.
It's very, very fast. there's a saying that there are no atheists in turn 9. and it is really tricky. Depending on the car you're driving, you might be flat out from the time you leave turn 5 all the way down the straightaway, all the way through turn 8. And then for turn 9, you might just lift, or you might have to drag a little bit of brakes, but not too much, because then you'll get some trail brake oversteer, which we've discussed earlier today. and you don't have a straightaway to set up for that. You go straight from being loaded up full throttle in turn 8 to having to then figure out where you're going to turn down for turn 9 and scrub some speed at the same time.
Wow.
Oh, and by the way, you might be doing 130 or more while that's happening. So it's really, really tricky and a very, very fast track. It's the fastest track in the state.
Wow. It's a track begging for like a major series to come there and like make use of the fastest track in the West, which I think it says on the, on the sign.
Yeah, that was their old slogan. And it would be a unique track in whatever series would go there too.
Because you're on the throttle so much, right?
Right. So it's a very old school track. It's less technical. It's more high speed. And there aren't really any tracks that fit that same description currently that are being used by these pro series. And it would just be a different challenge for the drivers and for the cars to tackle. So I think that's really cool. Get some more diversity in the types of corners, the types of race surfaces.
Very cool. And also be like, you know, if we have major series coming, like that means more stuff to build in town as well over there.
Maybe get a hotel.
Maybe a hotel. Yeah. Every time we talk about Willow Springs, the hotel thing. Yeah. So it could be a boon for Rosemont. So that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that'll do it this week for the Big Three. Thank you so much for watching. Nick, thank you so much for coming in and lending some of your expertise.
Thank you. Good to have you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
Good. Yeah, dude. Glad you had fun.
Great job on that vid.
Yeah, make sure you watch the video over on the drive, snap oversteer. You won't believe in that boogeyman anymore. You'll know what you're doing. It's all about the inputs.
And you know what? Sometimes boogeymen get you. So keep that in mind too.
Yeah,
great. And we have a couple more videos coming out soon as well that are going to dive further into different aspects of performance driving, some of the intricacies, some of the myths, and how these things actually work. So really excited to be producing some more of that stuff.
I'm so glad that you guys are doing more, because as soon as I saw that video, I was like, oh, Nick is like a natural at this, and just getting more of that knowledge out there is always very cool. So I'm very excited.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Awesome, man. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Nick at Nick Romano Racing. Is that one?
Oh, hey, that was right.
Yeah. Yes.
Ah! But that's N-I-K. N-I-K Romano Racing. Heck or at Fast Sideways if you want to follow the race school.
Heck yeah, dude. And follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to our crew, Edgar and Mark, behind the camera. And as always, thank you guys for listening. Hey, check out our automotive history show. It's called Past Gas. This week, it's Oldsmobile Part 2. Great story.
If you liked the Malaise era, this one's for you.
There's some cool cars in there.
Cool. I'd take a 442.
Yeah. Heck yeah, dude. Yep. Of course you would. All right. We'll see you guys next time. Bye.